Hi, I'm your host, Rowan Tonkin, and welcome to Being Planful, the show for FP&A leaders and planning experts. Welcome, everyone. I'm the host of Being Planful, Rowan Tonkin, the Chief Marketing Officer here at Planful. And today I'm really pleased to be joined by Zoe Cook, the Commercial Finance Director at MIQ. Welcome, Zoe.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm really excited. We had a little prep call yesterday to talk about this, and we covered some really fun ground for FP&A. And a couple of things that stood out to me about our conversation that you wanted to talk about today was firstly, soft skills in FP&A and how we can leverage soft skills to become a better FP&A partner to the business. And then we can get into some fun topics, because I know you've worked in the advertising industry for a long time, and I've got some hot seat questions for you about how finance should think about measuring advertising. Given my role in marketing, I always find it a very interesting topic of conversation. So firstly, let's talk about the soft skills. What do you see as some of the missing soft skills when you're talking to other FP&A folks? And how do you think we can improve them?
I really think that when we're training people in FP&A and in accounting more broadly, we really miss a trick by not also including things like how to give presentations, how to kind of go out and pitch, how to kind of do all of that kind of more sort of showy kind of extroverted stuff that typically is not included in a kind of accounting curriculum. And one of the things that I've really found in my career is that the things that make people want to work with you, that make you be able to be embedded within a business and actually help make those kind of strategic partnerships with business leads, is really actually being able to have a conversation, being able to turn up and sort of have people warm to you, and kind of all of the things that, if you did that sort of what does an accountant look like piece, they wouldn't be part of that at all. Now, I think that's a really sort of unfair label that gets banded at us all. But I really think that it's kind of a cliche for a reason, because we really need to work it. And I always think when there's those kind of stereotypes, especially about professions, that's kind of an invitation to learn how to kind of go outside that, because people are so surprised when you turn up and you're kind of bubbly and sort of want to know about them and, you know, remember their wife's name or husband's name and, you know, that sort of thing. But like, really feel to sort of those of us who've been brought up to kind of find the correct answer and come with cold hard logic, as kind of, oh, well, you know, that's for someone else to do that kind of thing, and we'll just come with the numbers. And certainly in my career, I've found that people will listen a lot more to the numbers piece if you can also do the sort of the personality piece as well.
And is that just your natural personality to be a bit more bubbly and be a bit more curious, or did you have to work?
Absolutely not. I wish I could say yes, but I have to say it's a bit of a kind of joke amongst my friends that I'm secretly a bit of a hermit. Where no one was worried about how I survived in lockdown, I can tell you, because sort of being not able to leave my house and just stuck inside watching telly and reading books, that's like my sort of like dream scenario. So it's certainly something that I've had to learn. It's certainly something that I've had to develop. I don't subscribe to anything that sort of says there's anything that people can't learn. I think you can learn absolutely anything. If you put some kind of thought into it and some action behind it, I'm a massive proponent of kind of do it until you become it.
That's great. I think the important thing that, you know, I'm hearing from you is you have that self-awareness, that it's a skill that you need to develop. And I think, you know, in my career, when I've met lots of people, the people who understand, you know, am I this or am I that? It's not that they don't believe that they can't learn it. It's that they have the awareness that they have to over-index to something. It doesn't come naturally. And so therefore they have to spend a little bit more time on it or prepare more for maybe a presentation, right? Some folks just feel free to jump on stage and kind of tap dance their way through a presentation because they've actually got that talent and that skill and it comes really naturally, whereas a lot of folks, you know, obviously it doesn't. When you think about times in your career where you've had to maybe give a big presentation, is there any specific moments where you've really lent into over-indexing to learning something beforehand, and how did that go?
Yeah, absolutely. My idea of hell is being put on the spot about anything. I can just tell you straight off about it. I hate it so much. The first time that I did a sort of big conference deck, and it was, you know, we want you to speak for 20 minutes. I'd literally written it word for word and learned it like I was learning a film script or something. I could probably still like do part of that presentation for you now, because I knew that if there was a sentence where I was going to say maybe instead of definitely, then I'd just sort of completely throw myself. Then we got to the end of this and then we said, okay, now we're going to open it up for questions. And no one had told me anything about questions at all. I just felt all of the blood like rush out of my head and leave my body. And I was stood on the podium kind of gripping it and thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to faint. But of course it was fine, because a lot of that stuff is kind of, you know, it's just, well, I say it's just anxiety. Anxiety is very real. But I don't know, there's something that my dad says that I always sort of cling to a bit, which is that the harder I work, the luckier I get. And I think that's one of those things, is anytime anything looks easy, it's usually because someone is so overprepared or has spent their whole career working on learning it. And I think that's one of my kind of, that's one of the things I really try and hammer home with our junior members of staff, is, you know, it's not that you can't do something, or it's not that it's easier for somebody else. It's just they're 10 years further down their career than you. So they've had 10 years of doing it, failing, learning how to get back up again, redoing it, understanding what it is we've been talking about.
And a lot of times, you know, the more seasoned you get in a specific space, whether that's, you know, B2B SaaS for me or advertising for you, you have much better pattern recognition. And so therefore you can spot the patterns earlier, and people are like, how did this person see that? And it's like, well, they've seen it about 15 times now. So if they didn't understand, you'd be concerned, right?
I really think that as you, something I've certainly noticed the last couple of years is there's, especially in FP&A, there's a couple of things that people always go back to. And that if you don't come from a kind of like private equity background or that sort of management consultancy background, kind of will completely throw you. But also make you sound really smart if you just go in and start talking about them. A lot of it is very much learned behavior. It's also a lot of hard work as well.
You talked about the lockdown. I know you're in London, and you've been through I think a lot of different lockdowns with
I think it was three, and it might have been four. It was like three and a half.
Yeah, and a lot of changing expectations from the government, from what I've read. I've got a lot of friends back there. I lived there for a while. Can you talk to me about how that has impacted, you know, the mental health of FP&A folks and your peers and your team? I know that, you know, certainly people that I've spoken to, the intensity of FP&A just became monumental in March timeframe, and it hasn't stopped. What's been your perception?
Yeah, so mental health is something that I'm super passionate about. I'm a mental health first aider, and one of the things I'm really proud about at MIQ is that I've been part of a team that's really been pushing mental health and mental health awareness as part of the kind of core wellbeing program. So we're just about to train, I think it's like 20 mental health first aiders in the UK. The sort of 3 weeks after we first went into lockdown, where essentially it was like, okay, the world might be ending. What do we do for the business? What do we do for the staff? I will say, and hopefully I will say this for the rest of my life, but I think that was probably the most stressful month I've ever worked. We basically didn't stop working for a month, and that was sort of me and kind of 6-7 other people. It was intense, and you know, I've always been very aware that recommendations that I make or analysis that I put forward has a human impact, but I don't think I'd ever kind of felt it as much as when we were then looking at 700 people's salary, mortgage payments, kids' school fees, all of that, you know, very real stuff that you can kind of disassociate a bit from when you're just looking at them as a part of a spreadsheet. And one of the things, I mean, I'll be sort of forever grateful to MIQ for is we took really, really swift action in terms of making sure that it was communicated to our staff that, you know, no one was going to get fired and would secure jobs for a set amount of time before it was even thought about. And really, I think what they did really well from a mental health perspective in terms of the broader business was really giving people that assurance that, you know, they were going to be able to make their bill payments, frankly.
Yeah.
From a sort of FP&A standpoint, obviously, it put so much focus onto what we did. And whereas probably the first year at MIQ, we'd kind of been able to be building kind of consistently, slowly, kind of thoughtfully around what we were doing, it was suddenly like, there's no time for that. We just need, you know, everything to be fixed now, everything to be changed now.
Yeah.
All of that stuff. Remodel the whole budget you've just spent 6 months working on. all of that sort of thing, which, you know, it really, for me personally, kind of put me in a bit of a kind of odd mindset. Because while all this sort of madness was going on outside, I didn't really have a chance to kind of think about, you know, what is going on with COVID and how kind of scared should I be or whatever. It was just like, okay, I've got a computer, I've got some screens, we're doing work. So I think, you know, while I think certainly for me, what happened was the kind of processing piece that a lot of people had done at the beginning where they were really scared, they were really frightened, was quite delayed. So I think I probably went through that sort of in the summer of last year, which I don't know whether that's a sort of good mental health thing or a poor mental health thing. But certainly, you know, it was a lot. And I think, yeah, I ended up in a kind of a bit of an odd housing situation where despite being well into my 30s, there was sort of a series of unfortunate events. And very fortunately, my parents just sort of said, come and stay with us. So it was kind of very visible to them how kind of strung out I was and stressed out I was, because obviously, you know, your parents used to sing you when you're happy, yeah, smiley, it's someone's birthday, it's Christmas, it's, you know, suddenly it was sort of, you know, oh God, like bags under the eyes to hear and, you know, really worried about what was happening with the rest of the business. So yeah, in answer to your long answer to a short question, but yeah, I think it really did take a toll. And I think what the sort of lasting impact of that will be is that a lot of people, I think now that hopefully we're past the worst of it, are really taking a long, hard look about what does work mean to me? And what does it mean within my life? And, you know, is it appropriate that for 3 to 6 months of the year while we're doing the budget, you know, you're working evenings and weekends, that you go through a quarterly cycle where, you know, you don't get to have a social life for a certain amount of time, you know. And I really hope that what can come from this is that people start to have a more realistic kind of work-life relationship. And I think you're certainly seeing that in a lot of the conversations that are happening around kind of flexi time and whether people are going to go back to working in offices or whether they're going to continue to work from home. You said you lived in London for a bit. So, you know, I shaved 2 hours off of my day because I didn't have to commute anymore, which was wonderful. But I didn't speak to anyone for a year. In, you know, face to face, which was horrible. So, yeah, it's definitely a balance, I think, at the moment.
My friends got really upset at me for my time in London because I used to walk. I lived in Chiswick and I worked in Hammersmith, so I'd just walk down the high street every day, sipping on a coffee. So, so I can't empathise. I should be able to. And now I'm being punished because it's a 1.5 hour drive to the office. So I'm being punished for my glory days in London. So when you think about so obviously that's the pressure that you as the FP&A team and the analysts really feel, that kind of, you know, we talk about FP&A being very cyclical and having very high spikes of intensity. And I think, you know, what I'm hearing from business leaders is now they've course corrected their expectations, right? Like what used to be a monthly requirement is now weekly, and what was weekly is now daily. And that is disconnected really from the burnout and the feelings of those people in those teams. Have you seen in your networks a way or people turning towards how to solve for that, how to solve for burnout of younger professionals, how to solve for that mental health challenge that you talked about?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. It is really tough. I am quite a proponent of, you know, just because it was rubbish when I was a grad, it doesn't mean that it should be rubbish for the grads who are coming through now. Like, you should make it better every sort of cycle. But, I mean, one of the things that COVID really did for our team was make us think about the way that we were producing things. And actually, you know, probably shouldn't say this, but we came up with some really creative solutions for things that previously we thought we couldn't do, because we'd never thought about, as you said, doing the weekly reports daily, or how we'd even prep that, or, you know, is there a way that we could make things more agile, more bespoke, because if we were being asked for it more often, you know, you can't rely so much on manual processes. You have to rely on a tech solution. So for us, the kind of the technological innovation side of it went like, but you know, what comes with that is all of the focus from the business, which was a lot. Luckily, MIQ is a growing company. So yeah. What's also come with that is a lot of investment. Which is kind of wonderful for what we're doing right now, because it's, you know, it's a whole different world in terms of resource, in terms of systems, everything, than when I joined 2.5 years ago. Because, and part of that is because we really demonstrated the value of our team within that time and over the last year. I'd be heartbroken if anyone had said we hadn't earned all of that, by the way.
Yeah. But I mean, quickly stop. Shout out to all the FP&A teams for last year. Every single FP&A team I know went through You know, we at Planful called it the ambush, then the triage, and then the recovery. And for a lot of folks, the ambush lasted for a really long period of time, depending on your business. So shout out to everyone in FP&A listening. Last year was super tough, and I know that intensity hasn't really gone away. So keep doing what you're doing, and keep asking for the resources. It would be my advice.
Yeah. In terms of dealing with the burnout of the younger staff, I really genuinely believe that having a good understanding of around issues around mental health and around mental well-being is crucial for management teams. So we know that 1 in 4 people within a year will have mental health concerns or mental well-being problems. And yeah, this is the first place I've ever worked where you as a manager are trained in how to deal with that. And, you know, if it's a quarter of your staff, that's too many people to not be putting money behind or not be thinking about. And, you know, I certainly, some of the things that, you know, people have accidentally said to me in my career around mental health has just been absolutely wild. And I really think that we're getting to a point where people have started to have the awareness of, you know, what is it okay to say? What is it absolutely not okay to say? And what is my responsibility as a manager to the people who I have a duty of care for? And, you know, their sort of pastoral care is also part of my job. And I know that, you know, a lot of people don't take that approach and kind of think, well, you know, their career progression is part of my job and their job performance is part of my job and that's it. Now, that might be true. You know, that might be what you think. You might think that staffing out your team is the only thing you need to deal with. There are stats around that if people have good managers who they respond to, they will have to take a 30% pay rise to consider going somewhere else. And, you know, getting a 2-day training in kind of how to actively listen to your staff is a hell of a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
Keep giving them those pay rises or having to look elsewhere for staff all the time, because we know that, you know, recruiting in costs way more than developing staff.
So absolutely.
I think my point is, like, if you can't view it on an emotional level, view it on a financial level.
Yeah. And the other thing I would say is, you know, when you're saying a quarter of your staff will go through mental health challenges in a 12-month period, I imagine that I don't know the data, and I probably should, but I would guess that that's probably even higher at management levels, right? And therefore, you've got very stressed out managers who are struggling to deal with their own things, trying to manage stressed out, you know, employees and teams. And that's not a good combination at all. I can tell you, if I looked at the number of mental health meditations on my Peloton app I did, it was pretty high in Q2 of last year, right? You know, I do meditations pretty frequently, but I'm sure it was a big spike in Q2 of last year, just trying to clear my mind of everything that was going on. And that's really important as a manager to do for yourself, because you can't help anyone else if you can't help yourself.
100%.
So let's turn to a little bit to advertising. So I imagine a big part of the stress for you during last year was the fact that a lot of budgets were pulled from a lot of organizations. So MIQ, fast growing organization in, you know, one of the epicenters of advertising, London, obviously London, New York. What was that like from a business perspective, just seeing, you know, probably media budgets being cut left, right and center? And how do you even think about modeling that?
From a business perspective, I think it was terrifying. You know, we, even thinking about how our sort of CRM setup was, we didn't have anything to say we've lost, you know, we didn't have a kind of data clicky to say, hey, we lost this business due to COVID. So it was things like, okay, we need to build that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we really put a lot of time into rebuilding our sales pipeline reporting.
Mm-hmm.
So we were looking at that basically once in the morning, once in the afternoon. You know, you'll know as well as I do that the first thing that gets paused as soon as there's any sort of recession, any sort of contraction in the economy is marketing spend. Anyone who's ever managed a budget will know that the first thing that first thing that gets taken away is T&E, and then second thing is marketing. And you know, that's really scary because then we're looking at this is our whole business, but we also have these kind of bright spots on the horizon as well of, well, okay, you know, we do a lot of work around the elections and,
mm-hmm.
you know, turned out to be the most expensive advertising election of all time ever, you know. We basically prepped a lot of different scenarios. I think we had 7 working models. And those were being updated, like I said, like sort of twice a day, really. We really had to sit right on top of it and try and work out what that was going to mean for the business. We also just decided this is what we'll view as an acceptable level of loss if it comes to that. It didn't. Actually, what we found was, so what we do essentially is buy ad space online for advertisers, for advertising agencies. And what we found was that inventory became quite cheap, but actually really effective because suddenly everyone was sat at home.
Yeah.
So, you know, suddenly your conversions start looking really good. And, you know, there was a month where it was, yes, really scary. And then we started to see things pick up. For us, a lot of the things that we looked at were we started drilling down much further into things like what categories are turning off and turning on. So, you know, it won't be a surprise to anyone, but advertising and travel really, really dried up last year. Things like that that are, you know, super high top level, but actually, you know, we don't really think about our business like that. We think about it with a very different lens. So what it did in terms of our reporting is actually now it's going to be so much more rich because we were sort of forced to think about all these things that, you know, previously we were sort of on the fence about how much of a role they played as levers. Whereas now it means that all of the models that we can build are sort of much more detailed, I suppose.
Yeah, much more complexity. I know we had to go through that ourselves. We did. I say that my product marketing team became a group of research analysts for about a month to try and assess, you know, who would thrive, who would survive, and who would unfortunately not make it, because that was the reality of what was happening. And so that's a complete new dimension into all of your models, right? Like industry or vertical or however you wanted to classify it. And so now you're getting that level of granularity, and you've given something to your point earlier around, you know, you proved the value of FP&A to the business. Now the business is like, wow, we've got vertical level information. We've never had that before. So that accelerant really, really occurred within your business, which is really interesting. But, you know, you're doing it under a really high pressure, forcing function environment.
I also really want to say that the sort of sales teams at MIQ were incredible. It was like the day after we went into, so we got sent home, I think it was a week before we actually went into sort of national lockdown. And I think it was the day after we got sent home, they were already planning, you know, I think they called it like make lemonade, like what are actually the opportunities that are going to come out of COVID? So let's focus on home fitness. Let's focus on leisure wear. Let's focus on, you know, at-home beauty, things like that. So from a strategic standpoint, like the business leads were, you know, phenomenal at saying, let's not just get stuck on focusing on what's being lost. Let's start thinking about what we can actually gain out of this as well.
Well, yeah, liquor sales probably went up too, I'm sure. I saw something that, you know, liquor sales for at home in the US went up by like 60% or something like that, which is quite scary. So in terms of, let's stay on the advertising front. What do you believe in terms of, should you measure everything in advertising?
Oh my gosh. I think you have to start with lots and then drill down and then sort of edit, I suppose is the right term.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that I probably saw more when I worked in e-commerce than when I worked in advertising is that when people just have all of the data, you end up in that analysis paralysis of I can't actually work out what's the sort of fulcrum that things are actually dependent on. I think that's right.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah. People will take over what they will. Yeah.
So, you know, instead you end up with too many variables. And from a financial modeling standpoint, you end up with something that's useless because it's almost like not sensitive enough, but also too sensitive to actually give you anything, right? So for me, what you need to do is work out what are your strategic priorities and then how do you build your models backwards from them? What are the things that you wanna, that really do actually contribute to changes within your business. What I kind of always say to the guys on my team is, if you think it's interesting, give it a go. See if it's there. If it's not, you've not wasted anything because you've learned a new ratio, a new skill, a new way of modeling it. If you put it all into a model and it actually doesn't change anything, then, right, you've lost half an hour of Excel work where you probably, you know, bolstered your kind of knowledge of how models work or understanding CPM or whatever.
Or you know that that's not a driver of the business, right? And, exactly. And you can rule it out for future. I think, you know, from my perspective, I think one of the things that when I talk to my FP&A partners is I really try and get them to think about the intent behind what we're doing, right? Like a campaign is not the same as another campaign, right? Like, and I think that's where my ask of FP&A leads is to come and sit with folks like me and try and understand the business strategy, because one campaign at a brand level will lead to no revenue, right? Because it's not intended to do that generally. But if it's a very D2C e-commerce business, which is like a shop now button, that's absolutely meant to lead to purchase, right? And so you want to optimize that for purchase, whereas the brand level advertising, you want to optimize for different metrics. And so my ask of FP&A folks is to go and figure that out with your business partners, because you can't just take, you know, impression CPM and create a ROAS model and look at it as one big model. It just won't work. I don't know if you believe that or not, but that's my philosophy.
I mean, I think the best experience that you can get is going and sitting with the people who sell what your business sells and say, hey, how do you sell it in? Like, what are the things that are important? What is it that when you're sat in front of agencies or advertisers that you're saying are the things that set us apart? Because that's what we should be measuring. Those are the things, that's the differentiators. We used to have this all the time actually at Groupon where, and this is, you know, this is going to date me, but it was kind of one of the first places that really played around with when you were sent an email, your campaign might be right at the top, or it will have different placement on the website. Mm-hmm. The planners would always, you know, this would be like the main thing, like where was it placed on the page? And, you know, not having had a marketing background, like I couldn't get into my head that that was the same as like, if you're in a supermarket, like, you know, where is, what cereal is placed where will determine which one you buy. And so they were doing all this like super cool, like A/B testing, which in hindsight should have 100% been part of our models. But, you know, we weren't mature enough at the time to kind of be able to be pulling that in. But it's those sort of things where unless you can understand why is this important to the business, why does the business spend so much time looking at these certain things, you're not going to be as effective of a business partner in your modeling as you would be if you had done that. One of the things that MIQ does that I think is excellent is whenever we have new joiners, they basically spend the first week sat with all the different teams and kind of learning what they do. And you know, as a hiring manager, it's quite frustrating because it means that you're first
your people. I want this person productive, yeah.
But what it means is that you don't have people who join and they're like, I don't know what programmatic is, because they've just spent a week learning it and learning what's important about it and all of that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's funny in that time frame, I think the kind of, you know, mid-2000s, people forgot that you know, it still was the four P's of marketing, and what you were talking about there was place, but everyone just assumed place was email, right? Yeah. But actually it was like a little P, which is place within email or place within website or place within, you know, wherever that thing was. And it's actually so important to that promotion or offer or product or whatever the other P's in marketing, I guess, price. Rowan, I should know these.
I was going to say, I feel like we're doing your kind of like, year one.
Yeah, but it's a good fundamental, you know, FP&A didn't learn the four P's in marketing, right? So if you're a business partner to marketing and you don't know what the four P's are, go and find out, right? Because it'll give you maybe a different paradigm than you're thinking about today. So talk to me about, you know, what's the next steps for Zoe Cook, right? Like, what are you trying to develop your skills in right now? Right now, you've got a team under you. You're really trying to mature them. You're trying to make the world you're trying to leave it better, right? But what are you trying to better in your personal career?
I think what I've done quite well so far is kind of taking teams from having quite a kind of immature data structure to something that's a lot more streamlined. And I think what I've always seen of myself is that, you know, that's quite a transitional role. Like you can kind of do that for 2 years and then people kind of want you to do other things. And so now I'm really trying to focus on those sort of other things and probably taking more of a broad perspective. That's why my role isn't FP&A anymore, it's commercial finance, because we're starting to think about more of the kind of commercial business partnering side and more of the sort of system side. And then how we kind of put all of that under the big umbrella and the FP&A piece, and then how we put all of that under the sort of umbrella of commercial finance. So I think, yeah, probably broadening. And probably doing more sort of accounting than I would naturally want to do, because I think now we're at a stage where, people are starting to talk about like valuations and what private equity houses might want to see and that sort of thing. And, that sort of more kind of due diligence piece. And I'm being realizing that I'm going to have to learn that by hook or by crook. So,
yeah. did you, what did you study when you were in college?
I studied government, and then I studied political theory for my master's. So it was about as far from accounting and finance as you could possibly imagine. I had the great pleasure of being one of the lucky people who graduated into the financial crash. So I went from kind of sort of being under the impression that any job that I could ever dream of, I could just walk straight into, and you know, I'd smile and everyone would just sort of fall at my feet for how clever I was. And ended up sort of, I think I was working 3 part-time jobs and living with my mum and dad, and bit just being like, this is like another level. And I did that for I think three, 6 months, and was just like, this is unsustainable. I'm tired all the time. Like, I need to get whatever the next job that I interview for. I'm just going to really, like, I'm really going to put a lot of effort into the interview. And I'd flunked, like, I don't know, I must have flunked like 20 interviews before that, which I, you know, is like the most demoralizing thing in the world.
Yeah.
It's really, I really feel for people who leave university and then need to find a job, because, you know, I've worked part-time jobs since I was 14, but at 22, I still had no relevant experience to do anything.
Yeah.
It was really demoralizing. And one of my friends had just started working at Groupon, which was, I think, 6 months old in the UK when I joined.
Wow.
And I basically, they rang me up. I haven't actually ever told this properly, so
we're ready.
They can't fire me now because they're not there anymore. But they rang me up, and it was like, I remember it so vividly because it was really snowy, and the signal in my house is terrible at the best of times, but even worse in bad weather. And they were like, yeah, we'd like you to come in and interview for a job in a team. And I was like, yes, absolutely, I will do that. So I went in having no idea what I was going to interview for. And I sort of had in my head, like, as long as it's not sort of accounting, finance, like, I can just flag it. Like, I'll say whatever. I don't mind, like, whatever. And I went in and they were like, so this is for a job for like an accounting intern. And I was sort of like, oh my God. And I was like, I don't care. I need a job so badly. And I don't know if they could sort of smell the desperation or if they also just needed people so badly. I think it's probably the latter. I made the best of it. And, you know, what I sort of realized was what you think that your life is going to be when you have to make those decisions at 17 is not what your life is going to be. And, you know, if it is, then that's great. And if you know what you want to do, like, excellent. If you don't have a clue what you want to do, or you have a very set idea and that does not transpire for you, it's not the end of the world. And, you know, yes, you might have to change your expectations. You might have to make the best out of something that you hadn't envisaged, but you absolutely can do that. I'm still not entirely sure I want to be work in accounting and finance. I'm quite far deep into it now. I don't know. I think you need to leave a bit of space in your life for that sort of uncertainty.
Well, it sounds like last year, you know, even though it was a very tough year, you got to kind of take that political theory and political understanding in your current role, right? Like, you know, if you understand the politics side of the world and you're in the advertising space, those two things meshing together must have been an interesting time for you.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that I really learned anything. I don't know if it would have helped if I studied accounting and finance.
Great, yeah. Well, it was funny, you said before, you know, in the marketing budgets are the first thing to get cut, and you graduated in the GFC. That was when I turned up in London trying to sell marketing software. It was in the middle of the GFC trying to sell to companies to sell them marketing budgeting software. They're like,
how did that go?
to budget what? So it was a tough few years initially, but eventually people realized that they could optimize their budgets using our software. So we did okay in the end. Funny kind of coincidence there. So Zoe, I want to be respectful of your time. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate your insights into advertising, but more importantly, the raw and honest conversation about mental health and mental health in finance. I think that was really important for folks. And I want to thank you for being a guest on Being Planful.
Oh, thank you for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks so much. All right, bye. Make sure you hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast so you don't miss an episode. Thanks for stopping by.